Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, this is Deborah Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the first week of March. This week, we are very pleased to present as our main topic, part two of our chat with Ron Sykes, speaking with us about wildlife habitat enhancement. Ron has been active with our local Audubon chapter, Admiralty Audubon, for a long while, and he and his wife Rosemary have been involved with wildlife habitat enhancement for at least the past 20 years in our area. And when he was in last month to speak with us, we had so many interesting things to talk about that we had to break the interview into two parts. In fact, the interview went so long that it left no room for our usual observations of the week section. So we will jump right into the main topic after we let you hear the mystery sound of the week. One of the perks of being a guest on our show is that you are given the option of choosing the mystery sound. And since Ron was on a two-part show, he got to choose two mystery sounds. He and I will tell you what it is and talk about what made him choose it towards the end of the program. Last month, we left off our great discussion with Ron Sykes just as we were starting to talk about how important water is in the landscape for wildlife. So, Ron, the ideal would be if we had a naturally occurring pond on our land. But failing that, what's the best way to provide wildlife with water?
There's a great variety of bird baths commercially available, and you can find one that will suit your landscape taste.
One thing I just read is how important it is not to have any metal on your bird bath. There was a wildlife biologist describing just this past winter how they had Anna's hummingbird frozen by the feet to the side of the bird bath. There's a happy ending. She saw it hanging upside down, struggling, and went out and just held the feet and warmed them and then allowed the bird to escape. But it's kind of like placing your tongue on a frozen surface that the birds can get stuck to it. If you're going to provide water, it's critical that you keep it clean and disease-free and then also free-flowing.
Easy way to keep water in a bird bath is with a dripper in quarter-inch tubing, which is connected to battery-powered water timer, and you can put that on your hose bib. You can even have it on a Y if you need to use it for other purposes as well. I mean, you can have a hose on one end of the Y and the timer on the other, and then that will keep the bird bath filled with water. I would like to also say that the design of the bird bath is important. You should have at least one side that has a shallow slope, or it should be a shallow bird bath, like, let's say, a ceramic water container that sits under a plant pot. If you're going to build one yourself, have at least one side that is shallow so that birds don't end up swimming. And the smaller birds don't seem to like to get in water deeper than an inch.
And they use it for drinking, but they also bathe and they get rid of mites, and it has it's multi-purpose.
Yes. I also would add it's good to have at least two baths, one for the little birds and then one for the bully robins set a few feet away.
That's a good idea.
Otherwise, the robins try to keep everybody out and the little birds can't get in there. An easy way to keep your bird bath clean is with a constricted nozzle on a hose. You blast out the bath and send all the old water and droppings away, because birds do have bad toilet habits around water.
Yeah, that's right. Shelter is one of the primary things that we can provide for wildlife. When we've talked a little bit about what forms this can take in snags, but you can leave old structures too, like old barns are great habitat, and even piles of leaf litter left to decompose in the fall. I wanted to make sure to have this program in the late winter before people get the urge to do their spring cleaning around their property. People think that they're doing a really good thing when they tidy things up, but wildlife doesn't really like tidy, do they?
No, most of our songbirds are bush birds, brush birds. They feed, find cover, even nest in brushy areas. So it's important to have some multi-layered planting or design in your landscape. Your trees, you have shrubs and ground covers and on down to your herbaceous plants.
And again, the value of a good dead tree left standing is really beyond compare. If it's truly unsafe left standing, then you can partially cut it so that there's still a short trunk left for feeding and nesting.
Yes, as we discussed earlier, standing dead trees are habitat for insects and other invertebrates. Once the wood is soft enough, even chickadees and nuthatches can excavate their own cavity, and certainly woodpeckers can. But also downwood on the ground is important for animals like the newts and shrews, but also the invertebrates that will feed them. If you prune fruit trees, if you pile your branches up somewhere, that will create good habitat.
And it returns nutrients to the soil, too.
Yes.
So there are all kinds of great things about dead wood, either standing or left on the ground.
Yes. If you have a tree that you think is a falling hazard, but you could allow so much of the trunk to remain standing and take down the rest, you would be saving a component of habitat that usually isn't available in most landscapes.
If you don't have a good snag left for cavity nesters, nesting boxes are a great alternative for some species. Do you want to tell us a little bit about nest boxes? I, again, really wanted to speak about those now because usually people, and that includes me, think about putting nest boxes up way too late in the season. Boxes need to be up in the late winter or very early spring before the birds arrive, or during the courting season when they're just starting to check out their nesting options. I made this beautiful nesting box last year about this time and intended for a small owl, but I never did get it up in time for them to use it. So tell us about nesting boxes, please. Why do we need to put them up?
Well, as we said, there aren't enough natural cavities for those birds that need cavities to raise their young. And I think there's about 10 species we see in our city and parks that are cavity nesters. Out there where there's larger blocks of habitat, we could probably expand that list to include some small owls. So what are the target species I'm talking about? There's four or more woodpeckers that use cavities in our area, and with the right snag, they can create their own. These are the downy, the hairy, and if you're really lucky, a pileated woodpecker, and the northern flicker. The other candidates I would talk about are black-capped chickadee, chestnut-backed chickadee, Buick's wren, house wren, and the violet-green swallow.
So a lot of great species that you'd want to have. But there's a big problem with some non-native species using the boxes, isn't there? I mean, people have to be vigilant to not get house sparrows and starlings using those nest boxes.
I was told by an Audubon biologist that the reason we no longer have western bluebirds in our area is because the starlings took over all their nest sites, or at least enough of their nest sites that they can no longer maintain a population here. If you put up nest boxes that a starling or a house sparrow can get into, they will take it over and keep other birds from nesting. So you won't be able to benefit the chickadees, the wrens, the violet-green swallows.
So you have to be kind of hardcore. If you see those birds using them, you have to remove the eggs and nests of those invasive species.
Well, hopefully you would catch them before they get to the egg stage and throw their nest out. But you also need to put a cover over the opening that has a smaller hole. I recommend a hole no larger than 7/8 inch at its widest point. And I also recommend you make it either diamond-shaped or an elongated oval. And this allows the bird not only to get its head in, but it can get its wings easier into the opening. Starlings cannot get into that small opening, and many house sparrows have a hard time getting their head through. So you can pretty much exclude them if you will keep the hole no bigger than 7/8 inch. This works for chickadees, wrens, and nuthatches, and also violet-green swallows can get through that opening. For a larger bird like a tree swallow or a northern flicker, then you're going to have to daily monitor a box you put up to see that it's not taken over by a house sparrow. Or in the case of the flicker, the hole would have to be big enough that a starling could get in.
And there are some great resources out there for the specifics. It's amazing the hole size and shape and the orientation of the box of the sun, how high it's placed. I mean, there are lots of different things to attract specific species that come into play. And there are, if you just Google online nest boxes for, say, tree swallow, you should come up with a lot of good ideas, right?
Yes. For swallows, they need to have a clear flight path to and from their box. You don't want to locate a box too close to trees or shrubs. A great place for violet green swallows is to have a box under the eave of a house, but that's also very attractive to house sparrows. For swallows, I would keep the box covered until the swallows are here and are actively flying. They will fly around the box, let's say late April, and then you can open your box and hopefully they'll go in. They do try to defend their box once they've got it established from house sparrows. Once they're established, they will fight for it.
Uh-huh.
But the violet green swallows, if a house sparrow gets in, you're going to have to eject it because the violet green swallows can't eject a house sparrow.
Uh-huh.
And then after the nesting season, clean the boxes and then cover them until the following nest season. Starlings and house sparrows start nesting in March, and once they get established in a nest site, they'll be preoccupied. So hopefully when you open up your swallow boxes in late April, first week of May, the swallows will be able to get established before there's trouble with the starlings or
house
sparrows.
So what about bat roosting boxes and boxes for Douglas and flying squirrels? I have a funny story about bats and flying squirrels and boxes that we put up for them over the years. I love bats, and one of the first things that we did when I bought my property was put up a bat house. But it wasn't until we started framing my own house years later that I finally got bats roosting. But in the corners of my house, not in the one that I had put up with them in mind. I also love flying squirrels, and I had the best look that I've ever had of a flying squirrel leaping out of a box that we'd intended for a cavity nesting bird. The lesson is that you never know what you're going to get when you create wildlife habitat. So what do you think about bat and squirrel boxes?
I know the squirrel boxes can be successful. I have a friend that the Douglas squirrels have taken over most of the bird boxes
he
puts
up. Yeah, I have
up,
that problem,
and they
too.
Just create the size hole they like.
Uh-huh.
They don't worry about if it's a little small because they have the ability to open it right up. If you live where there's still a block of forest, there's a good chance of having not only a Douglas squirrel, you might be lucky enough to get a flying squirrel. I had a friend that lived out on Maristone Island, and he had some large Douglas firs and grand firs by his house, and he one time scared a flying squirrel out of his box, which was a real treat.
Well, that's
so
the same with me.
They are here where there's enough forest.
Uh-huh.
The thing I've been told by people from Bats International and is also mentioned in Russell Link's book on landscaping for wildlife is for bats, in our cool climate, it's necessary for it to be in a warm location. And he suggested you place your bat box on the side of an outbuilding where the greater capacity of the building to hold heat will keep the bat box warmer.
Or paint it dark. So the last thing that the Washington Department of Wildlife handout mentions is critical for wildlife habitat is space. Recognizing that for several species of wildlife, the size of most backyard habitats will not be sufficient for their requirements. But that doesn't mean that they won't use your property or travel through or rest in it or nest in it or feed in it. It just means that they will need to use your neighbor's property too, or maybe all of your neighborhood and more. It's a well-known principle in wildlife ecology that species will need less territory size if the territory is more abundant in resources. What other things can we do to make our property more resource-rich from a wildlife perspective?
Well, certainly if you could interest your neighbor or neighbors into creating wildlife habitat in their landscape, then that would improve conditions in your neighborhood.
And it's a great way to know your neighbors, too, is to go introduce yourself. it's important to have a really diverse landscape. And we talked before about how layering different trees and shrubs and forbs are really important. Edge effect is also really important to retain for all kinds of species of wildlife, right?
Yes, and I would suggest you consider a perimeter landscape plan where your house is located somewhere in the middle and your landscape wildlife plants and structures are a border that cover as much of the perimeter of your landscape as possible to give them as large of area where you can have a multi-layered canopy, you can create a covered site with grouped conifers or evergreen shrubs or a close grouping of deciduous shrubs for nesting, feeding, and shelter from weather.
It's clear that the subject is vast, and there are some great reference materials out there if people want to read more, right? You were telling me about a great book that you had found. What is that again?
Well, first, again, I'd like to mention Russell Link's book, Landscaping for Wildlife in the Pacific Northwest. It is so oriented to what we need here in Puget Sound Country. The other I mentioned was Doug Ptolemy's book, Bringing Home Nature Now. If you're interested in what plants do well in the Northwest landscape, I recommend Arthur Kruckberg's Gardening in the Pacific Northwest.
It's a classic. It's an old book, but it's still really appropriate.
I have read other books about landscaping for wildlife, but they try to cover a larger area, so it's not quite as specific as the information you'll get from Russell Link's publication. His book is in our library, or you can purchase it at the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife's website.
Well, and speaking of that, the Washington Department Fish and Wildlife website is great, and it also sponsors a cool program called the Backyard Wildlife Sanctuary Program. So go to their site and read those books, and we've run out of time again. So thanks so much for joining us, Ron.
Hey, thanks for your interest in Backyard Wildlife and for having me here to talk about it.
Oh, well, it's been a great pleasure. We have a bunch of great upcoming natural history events to tell you about this week.
First, come join the Jefferson Land Trust for a couple of work parties, one of them on Friday, March 10th at the Upper Snow Creek Forest Preserve, and the second Tuesday, March 14th at the Chimicum Commons. Go to saveland.org for details.
There is a nice low tide happening this week, and the Port Townsend Marine Science Center is taking advantage of it to guide you on a nighttime low tide walk at North Beach to check out all of the cool creatures to be seen then. The event takes place on Wednesday, March 8th, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. to take advantage of the 1-foot tide occurring at 7 p.m.
Then on Saturday, March 11th, you can thank them for the walk and all of the other great things that they do for the marine environment by coming to their biggest fundraising event of the year, the Tides of March Benefit Dinner and Auction. Go to ptmsc.org to get details on both the low tide walk and the benefit event.
Olympic Peninsula Audubon up in Squim has several events planned this week, the first of which is a snowshoe hike sponsored by the Dungeness River Audubon Center's Explorers Club, planned at Hurricane Ridge on Friday, March 10th. Then on Saturday, March 11th, you will have the choice of two events, a field trip to Morse Creek and a class on spring gardening for birds. Go to OlympicPeninsulaAudubon.org for more information on all of these. And here's our mystery sound again. It's a purple martin, the largest of our area swallows, a beautiful, graceful bird with the male and unmistakably glossy purple-blue. To quote Ron, when I first asked him about what he would like to choose for a mystery sound for our radio show, quote, "The first thought for a favorite sound is the chortle of purple martins overhead. Once learned, you can tell that they are foraging overhead, even though they may be 400 feet above," unquote. It's a lovely sound, but we ended up choosing the song sparrow for part one of our show because the song sparrows are here year-round and started to sing in mid-February. While we will not be graced with the presence of the breeding purple martin population until mid-April. Purple martins have a hard time finding nesting cavities in our area now, what with the loss of snags and suffering displacement by European starlings, and they are now largely dependent on nesting boxes to successfully produce young. Ron and his wife Rosemary have been very involved with putting up some of these nesting boxes, and what follows is an excerpt from our discussion with Ron last month about this. So speaking of nest boxes and competition for them, you had some successful purple martin boxes put up at the Port Townsend Marine Science Center, right?
Starting in 2005, Admiralty Audubon meeting, I asked for help establishing a purple martin colony down on the Port Townsend waterfront. And member Jay Brevik, the late Jay Brevik, unfortunately, he's no longer with us.
No.
He said, I can do it. And it wasn't too long until he had got permission from the port manager, and he'd put up four boxes on post at the mouth of the Port Townsend boat haven. We early visited boxes in late April. We didn't see any purple martins. Rosemary and I forgot about it. Then one day I got a call from a friend over at Olympic Peninsula Audubon, and he says, a fellow named Stan Koska is trying to get a hold of whoever put up the purple martin boxes. There's purple martins there.
Yay, how exciting.
So that year they fledged four, and Stan, who has a banding permit, he banded the four fledglings. From then on, there were purple martins coming to those boxes. But Stan told us that if we would move some boxes out onto pilings, which were nearby to boat haven, we'd have even better success. For whatever reasons, martins like to nest over open water along marine areas, and it seems to be the case throughout Puget Sound, even up into British Columbia. That's their preferred place to nest in a box.
Oh, that's great.
I don't know why. So we built boxes, we put them on the pilings, and every box had purple martins successfully fledged young.
Wow.
Then we were told by DNR that they were going to pull those creosote pilings, which leak toxic creosote in the water, so we had to move them back onto land.
And did the nest success go down then?
It did. We ended up going to one box per post. Then you ask about the Marine Science Center pier boxes. Then Rosemary was contacted by the Northwest Trails Association. They were looking for a conservation project for their crew. So five of them came to our house. Rosemary got the materials together, and they built four boxes. Admiralty Audubon provided the materials. We got the Marine Science Center staff, got permission from the state, and we put up four boxes at the Marine Science Center pier. First year was not successful.
What's the status of those boxes right now?
The last couple of years, all four boxes have fledged two or more young.
Please give us an update on how those purple martin boxes are doing at the pier later this season. And that's it for KPTZ's Nature Now for the first week of March. Thanks very much for joining me, Charlie, and thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 11:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. As always,
happy trails!
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Closing music this week is from Wings performing Wildlife.